Since I forgot to turn the recorder on earlier, I'll spit those quotes of Meher Baba's about the halo and aura in the on the page for the minister's talks. So David had several things happen around him that I witnessed, and I know many others have too. And it's funny how it came in very strong forms sometimes and very subtle forms others. I think the best example for this is the power of God that came from his hugs. I think this is, in that sense, he really passed on what it was like to be with mother, because it is a very similar feeling. And because it's selfless, it is his gift that he gave from himself. And gurus pay a huge price with that kind of physical contact. So you can imagine what it was for mother. And then, of course, we're all aware of Amma giving these very long hugs and what she takes on too. But mother was unusual in that hugging. For her, you know, the SRF and all of that wasn't done elsewhere. But it was in mother's nature to see all of us as her children. So I came across this little short piece that David wrote. You know, several times over the years, we had to deal with things that we wish we hadn't had to. That it kind of affects your faith in God and the path and everything. But this is how David came through one of these. And this was about 2001. I don't have the exact date on this one. It's in some other emails around July of 2001 while he's at Cloud Mountain. And I think I've got this date approximately right because of other things he said in the letter. See, he said, the idea came to me. This movement is bigger than any one person. It is the movement of God consciousness. I was walking on my deck in circles, chanting, and the dialogue ran through my mind. Well, what do you know to be true? I know what I experienced with mother. I know what I have experienced with him. Of those things, there is no doubt. And then the idea came. That is part of following this guru lineage. You take the good with the bad, the up with the downs. It is part of the heritage. Then the idea came. The purity of God and the upliftment, everything I have in God came from mother. She received from master and papa. I owe them everything. So that's the bricks and mortar of loyalty and love for the guru and certainty of following one's destiny. And apropos of that, I have another quote of Meher Baba's that's given us all over the years. I think some of you have heard this before. But Meher Baba says, one generally passes through three stages in the spiritual life. The first stage is of burning enthusiasm, when the aspirant is imbued with the keen desire of seeing and experiencing the unknown. The second stage is of disgust and disappointment. The third is of divine bliss. The second stage in which you are at present is very long. Since you cannot escape from it or remedy it, you must put up with it cheerfully. Don't leave me in any case. And this is something that gurus insist that if you, that all will be forgiven, that anything can happen between the guru and the disciple, but that you never leave the guru. You never, the guru won't leave the disciple. That's axiomatic. But that you have one responsibility, like a child, to never leave your parents, to never let anything knock you off the path. And it will come. It can be very difficult. And it can be something that you will never have understanding for. And then the other aspect of that is that it goes into the well, it goes into the water, and it becomes not an issue. It isn't something that gets resolved. It might always be a mystery. And we shouldn't look for resolution. We should take it for what it is. It's a difficult grain of sand upon around which we must build a pearl. And we learn to live with it and not understand it. If God wants us to understand it for teaching purposes, teaching yourself, or to teach others, so be it. But in the path of the individual disciple, it really does not matter. It really can be eventually seen. These are difficult things to imagine, because we all know that it's not just someone insulting you or someone hitting you with their fist. It can be killing. It can be horrific things done to people. Horrific things have been done in warfare and other aspects of life. All the mentally ill people taking it out, taking their issues out on other people and visiting it upon any one of us or our family members. So it isn't to be looked at in a light way that it's going to be easy to do, or that we can intellectually get past it. It will get into your vitals. But you have to maintain that connection to the Guru and God. You have to take that attitude that you can live through anything. And that you have to. That really ultimately is the thing. Holding on to the hem of Meher Baba's garment, and mother said, hold on to her for whatever you can. If we learn nothing else, if that's the only thing we learn in this life, that's sufficient to take you all the way. The Guru truly is everything. Now, what is the Guru? Mother always said God is the Guru. And if we find fault with God or the Guru, we can do either one. We should first of all expect that. We're disappointed in our own lives, or our own inability to measure up in every way, all the time anyway. Good days and bad days in that respect. But we can hold on to the Guru, because the Guru, as I'm now defining it, is the highest principle in your life, is the highest goal in your life. Before we knew about the Eastern notion of gurus, we had a notion of Christ, and we had a notion of saints who could get us closer to the Christ and closer to God. We need that desperately. And we will be tested on it, and we will be able to make it through. That's one cycle that seems to always come, isn't it? That we get through a difficult situation and we get up on the plateau and we are able to breathe easily. And we look back and we see, oh, I'm so glad I stuck with it to this point. It's so very much worth it. One thing we can do is, and that meditation is so valuable for, it is a similar state to ecstasy and to bliss. In other words, you certainly will feel bliss with meditation, and that as you descend or ascend, however you want to look at it, but you lower the body, it lowers your mind in your body, it lowers down into the center of your being. And you, but at the same time, you ascend to the heights because your eyes are looking up. But it is interesting how we settle into the heart and then we look up and we become a child at the heart with the rays of light coming down from the sun at the solar plexus, I mean at the third eye. And we can settle into that and we can learn that we can do it. We can see ourselves doing it. You can get to the point where your body's aches and pains are completely gone, and all of your thoughts. Either one of those things is beneficial, but both together are what the goal is. It's to withdraw without any thoughts of the outer world, with total focus on God, and feeling within your body, either disconnected from the body or completely relaxed in it. Every muscle, even if it is not, even if it is tense, not relaxed, when you get to this state, you don't feel it. This is why people who can even be very sick can go into higher states. And the body can be under in turmoil, and you can get beyond it. But that takes practice. But it is something that can be done, and it's very valuable to do it. Because that's the groundwork for the ecstatic state, the bhava state. And these are not states you stay in, but they are signposts on the way. And you then feel that you can do the next part. And you ascend a little higher, sometimes a lot higher, when you don't even know it. And you can feel the bliss coming up through your spine. It's exactly as we're taught in yoga. It is exactly that it is the spine and the brain. It's the only true religion in the world for men and for mankind. It's the journey of the spine and the brain. And the cross and the Christ are simply another way of saying that. The Christians have it in their own way. Mayor Bob has been a very powerful influence. I think David and I both, when we discovered Mother's love of him in reading in the mid-60s from him, and then when I was first with her, she would recommend books to us. And that was just for that period or a year or two that she was talking about that. And she, as I said, if not last time, time before, The Power of the Subconscious Mind, Sexual Energy in Yoga, Yoga and Health, of course, Yasudian and Hake also involved in that. But she also, as far as saints, she mentioned Meher Baba. She liked Kirpal Singh and his way of teaching. She liked Joel Goldsmith. Now, he was a very interesting person. He knew Master. And I'm not sure where it was. I think it may have been Encinitas, but it could have been out in the desert. Anyway, he was allowed, master allowed, gave him use of the property. They were fairly close. And Joel Goldsmith used to, he was formerly with, or maybe always was, stayed with the Christian Science religion. And so he was, you know, health conscious in a higher sense. He wasn't dogmatic about it, that if you manifested some illness, that was your fault. He wasn't that kind of person. But he was aware very much so that the mind really does control, the conscious mind really does control what we get, what we have, and what we deal with. At different times in our lifetimes, we've had our conscious mind doing things that cause us grief in this lifetime. And they show up in what are called samskaras, or things that attach themselves to us, and all these little worrying areas of how this mechanism works about karma and all that. But and there's not denying any of that, but it doesn't help to focus on it too much. But we do recognize that when the conscious mind in another lifetime was exercising its power on the subconscious and your karmic patterns, your samskaras, developing them negatively anyway, that those things will show up in your subconscious mind now. So, and it will be the mind is working through those things, trying to understand them, but also robotically moving through those things that your conscious mind was dealing with you. But this is why the conscious mind was so, Mother put so much emphasis on it when I was first with her, that this conscious mind was the thing which fed the rest of the, it fed everything. And so we have to make the best use of our time awake to keep the mind feeding good thoughts as best we can. This idea that we have to do, you know, certain things in formulaic ways, for me personally, has always been difficult to take that, because I've always had some things come to me and not easily, but just come to me fully fleshed out, fully born. And I look back and I see that I didn't do anything to get them necessarily, except to open my mind and open my heart and keep my mind on God to the extent that I have. But any use of mantras and ways of thinking are really good ways of avoiding other problems that come up from our past, and for programming the mind, what, to get good results and good karma. Mother warned us about this, you know, that the a saint consciousness still has good karma that you have to come back and resolve. You really, it's a strange thing to say. You don't want bad karma. But you have to be careful also with being too good or doing too much good in the sense of it attaching itself to you. These things can be better, you know, in drawn or put onto your consciousness, knowing that you're constantly trying to do this work and not focused on the results, and not thinking of getting good karma and getting a better job, all of those things, and a better house, all those things are fine, but that is not the goal. And if that is part of the goal, it will be something you have to come back for. Everything you desire has to be provided to you in some fashion. What? Because God's just that kind of a robotic replacement? No, it's because we are. We wouldn't have these thoughts or these desires or a lifetime even to put them forth as a request, as a possibility. This really is why any state that you're in, no matter where you are, in what world, what society or anything, God's available to all people in all places. And the idea that we have to have a one of the higher religions in the world, or the more sophisticated religions, is not necessarily true. Great souls are born amongst tribes that are of a lower nature, just coming out of the animal kingdom to guide them. And they, you can, and we know that people go through tremendous experiences by being simple. Brother Lawrence, so many saints of a simpler type around St. Francis. None of them were, these were sophisticated in the sense of the way that we think of that intellectually. But this is also, to complete a thought I had earlier, the Bhava state is such a wonderful state because it's really the ground, it lays the groundwork for better and deeper meditations and for the higher states and for the, a platform to be on. But beware of it. So I'll mention too another thing that people talk about, that we have to, you know, beware of our connection to the guru, or beware of our well, especially the connection to the guru, but to connection to other people also. And that they must be recognized for what they are. They're tremendous positions to be in. If you're at the position where you only see the guru as being the greatest thing in your life, and that's all there is in your life, all right, so we can know intellectually that maybe we'll have to do something about that. We'll have to break that connection, that desire nature aspect, or the attraction to it. But my point is, recognize that for what a gift it is. It's a tremendous state to be standing at. It's a tremendous thing. Never dishonor or dis the guru, thinking that I don't want to get attached to the guru. I mean, all right, we can know that intellectually, but it shouldn't be something we focus on. The attachment of the guru is, don't worry, the guru himself or herself will withdraw, because they are only the face of God at the moment. And as we get closer to that face, all things blend and it all goes away. But I do think to focus on the guru is so essential, and not worry at this stage or at some stages. When you're up against it and you know you can't go anywhere because you're so attached to it, all right, then this is where the lesson is there. But I think people tell these things too soon, and people get, you know, wary of the path and don't want to take part in the path. Because, or especially the connection to the guru. And we do see idolatry around the guru, or whatever you want to call it, too much focus on it and on the guru as a person. And it does have problems. I get all that. But don't miss the fact that it's also it's a better state than the average person has in the world. And that it is a doorway to further states. It's not an end in itself. And so bhava, ecstasy, bhava type of state, which is a lower form of samadhi, is nothing to worry about. It's a definite marker, but to go beyond it, to not revel in it and not to stay in it, to then lift the mind higher, lift yourself higher, to go into a state where you're not feeling anything in the body, you're not feeling anything but this bliss of God is the right word if we correctly understand it. It changes, it morphs into this state of recognition within yourself that God is all there really is. There's only God. It's the big secret. And then we have to work with words and wonder and think about what God is, what the word God means. Maybe that's for another day too. We can get beyond that as a construct, as an idea. because God comes to you and he does the work. He lifts you into the state of seeing that how much more it is, how much this great expression of God is beyond our greatest notions, beyond our greatest expectations. Everything is so much greater than we can imagine it in the Spirit. And look for that. Be ready to be surprised in a good way, that it's as simple as it is. And I know I'm speaking to many people here who have had these experiences, so these are reminders. But Mother has had me reviewing all those years with her in the early days so much lately. And the command has come down.
Larry, can you talk a little more about the second stage of disgust?
Pretty rough thing to read, isn't it?
And the be joyful part of in it.
There does seem to be an interminable aspect to it, the second stage for sure. When we turn our minds and our eyes to God, that is a tremendous honeymoon. And we all, most of us have had it. And don't worry too much if you haven't had it. It could have manifested in a different way for each person. But it's often talked about. And it's undeniable, the honeymoon stage. But the second stage, let me read it to you again. So the first stage is of burning enthusiasm. The second stage is of disgust and disappointment. The third is of divine bliss. The second stage in which you are at present is very long. Since you cannot escape from it or remedy it, you must put up with it cheerfully. So, this is the point. This is the time of sadhana and to keep your mind on God and to wait expectantly. You know, years ago, we were at the church on 27th Street with Mother. So that started in 1980 Kriya. We had 1980 Kriya there, and then we started that fall with meeting at the church, the Congregational Church on 27th and about 155th. Interestingly, David lived about a block or two away from this church, too, during that time. But I remember being in the one side before and after church. I don't remember why I was there. And I would look out the window, and I had this certainty or this expectation that I would see Krishna. It was just a short time I was interested in Krishna. I've had much more interest in Mother and more Christian things in later years. But during this time, I finally got Krishna, I think, or at least I got a part of him that I was expecting him to step out of the shadows. So I had this idea that I could look out the windows from this church and I could see him because it was always in the evening that this happened. It was dark outside. But I always took that as expectation. That was happening during times of my own sadhana and being fully engaged in this path with Mother. I had no place else to go. I knew I wasn't going to be anywhere else. I had no other interest in long-term issues of the great issues of life, the great reasons for being here. I knew early on that I would be with Mother. Well, I mean, it's easy to say that. You don't know. I mean, how many other people who fell away and many others who just haven't fallen away but just don't come and aren't actively involved at the present time. So there's everything in between. But for myself, I always felt I would be doing this work with Mother of some sort. But, you know, she never talked about it. She ordained me, and that was kind of an indicator. But there was no talk before that, hardly at all. It occurred, it happened when she was, we had gone to see the movie, The Last Temptation of Christ, and with David and Elvie and Kate and I and Mother, so the five of us. And we came out of that, and she just looked at me and she said, "I'm going to make you a minister." I think it happened within a few weeks after that. But it's so much was unsaid between us. So I never had an interview. I never sat down and talked to her about my problems. And these are not, I'm not saying this is the right way to do things or the wrong way. It's just that my relationship with Mother seems to have been something that when I first met her, I just knew this was exactly what I was here for. I recognized that she was different than I imagined a guru, for sure, as David speaks about so beautifully. But the certainty was there. I also think, though, she really did take all of us in hand inwardly. We were having her thoughts on us, and we were having some inner connection. Because if I look back on it, I really don't know. You know, how would I have looked to my family members? Now, my mom eventually became a disciple of Mother's, but other family members must have and still do really wonder about me and Kate and our, you know, smaller family here. I'm sure a lot of you have the same thing happen. But I was so oblivious to any. I didn't care about criticism if there was any. And they were all polite. But, I mean, it wouldn't have bothered me. The certainty was there from the moment I met her. But the second stage is a long one for sure. It is just a matter of sticking with it. And having faith, what? In God, yes. But in your own destiny, would you be here if it weren't already in the cards something you wanted, what you came for in this lifetime? Most of us feel that it wouldn't be any other way.
Is the disappointment referring to just how difficult life can be?
Not so much life can be, that's true too, but that you don't get pulled out of your life perhaps, and the disappointments and the difficulties of your life, mm-hmm. but that that you think when you're first on the path, oh, I'm going to make so much progress because I'm making so much progress, and it's pretty easy. You know, during the honeymoon time, it's really pretty easy. And it's so joyful and so wonderful. And so you think it's going to continue, and it doesn't. So and it's the expectation of spiritual advancement, I think, is mostly what's being discussed there. Talked about as being, you know, we're disgusted with ourselves sometimes in that sense of disgust, I'm sure. is what he means. I think in the, well, how did I get here, and did I waste too much time to get here, and why am I still involved in this? Those are more human things, and sure, that can be discussed also. But I know how Meher Baba teaches generally, and he mostly is, like Mother did, holding out the highest expectation for the greatest results and the greatest attainment.
You know, for me, it was the dichotomy between that early taste of honey, mm-hmm. and this thing that you've been thirsting for all your life that you didn't know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's, you know, the thirst is quenched. Mm-hmm. The unquenchable thirst is quenched. And you say, I found it. You know, this is it. And then it's time to earn the bottomless fountain.
I mean, not to say there aren't people who, like, you know, who go right through it very quickly, but for the vast majority, and that's who he's teaching. He's teaching people. You know, he even said about the people who are closest to him that you will, you will not have an easy time of it now, and you won't understand. But when I'm gone, people will come to you and they'll ask you what it was like to be with me. And that's your time. That's what this is all about. It's going to be hard to do what you're doing now, and you don't get much appreciation or everything. And
the image that came to me is that for me, I was always one, if we go hiking, I hated switchbacks. I'd wanted to cut the trail. It was three times as hard, but much quicker, and that's how I've tried to imagine this path as, you know. But that disgust and that, what was the other? Disgust and...
And disappointment. And disappointment.
It's so, it seems like, that's so universal for us that stick around. And those who don't, you know, that's why. I know for me, it's been that idea of, can I actually get there? And when I finally believed with David telling me so many times that, no, it's closer than you think. It's just the thinnest veil, and being told that over and over and over again allowed me to stay when it's gotten difficult. They promise us that.
Well, you know, it's interesting to think of it in this way, that we have towards the end of a life, as we get older, we get tired. We think, you know, I just don't know that I want to go on with this. These are elements of getting older. I don't mean to say spiritually, but there's just that you think, well, gosh, I am so tired now. I can't imagine starting another lifetime and and going through this again. I just can't. I mean, my gosh, yet we've done this many times. We've done it already many times. And each time we start afresh, having a new, fresh body, but it's also stressful. It's very difficult to have a young body and to develop it and make it work and learn the language. All of these things take so much focus.
Train that horse.
Yeah, again. And you've done it before. You know, you're doing it again, and it's just as hard each time. Just to get to the point where you can meet your guru and then go to the next level. So
I love that analogy that David makes of the video game, and that's, I think, where part of that disappointment and disgust comes, is the first level when you're first meditate and first spend time with the guru and get that first contact high,
right,
and that upliftment, and it's so easy, and then, you know, like the video game, then you drop into the next level, and everything's coming faster and harder, and the meditations have to go deeper, and
right.
But then the achievement is greater. And And each one strengthens us for the next.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember being in my honeymoon phase, and I don't remember who said it to me, but another devotee just said, well, it's going to get a lot harder.
Thanks a lot.
To me, when I was like all blissed out,
and, yeah.
you know, following David everywhere and, you know, just, and again, I don't remember who it was, but I think they were maybe in that disgusting. And I was in the honeymoon and they were kind of envious, maybe.
Well, you know, that happened to me, too, with some mother's family, even. And, you know, I was kind of impervious to that idea that I knew that I was being Pollyannish. So I knew that they were kind of not critical, but they were trying to set some balance, you know, in the whole thing, that whatever I was talking about, enthusing about. But yeah, it's certainly what they were saying was reflecting the state that they were in, the second stage, for sure. Yeah. And again, the second stage, a person could leave the guru, or leave the group, I should say, and not leave the guru. So we have to be careful. You know, mother's children were really, really high souls. And we don't know. Just don't know. But it certainly didn't dissuade me at all, or didn't even dampen my enthusiasm. I recognized what they were saying, though, and I took it in. I took it on as something to recognize and to know that they're telling me the truth. But I actually, the other thing is, I felt sorry for them.
Mm.
What were they saying to you?
Oh, mostly just dampening my enthusiasm for Mother a little bit, because they knew her well. And I can't think of too much else. It was that nature anyway. It wasn't bad. There was no bad connotations with it. It wasn't dismissive, let's put it that way. It wasn't dismissive of me or of Mother, but they were trying to give me some balance, but they were reflecting their own disappointment in their own life. That's what they were doing, because you can't help it. And it's important for us not to do that to the extent that we can. We can't stop ourselves from telling people what we went through. That can cast a pall on things. Well, I think I'll try to bring some I have two goals until Swamiji gets around. I need to get a video or two out, and so I want to talk about the video and talk about him as we get more of these things to look at. So I'll try to get that done. But the other thing is to read more of David's, our discussions back and forth, and some of the emails and letters and stuff. I know that the last Sunday we had this talk of David's from 1992. My gosh, amazing, isn't it? How much he was speaking in the way he did later in life. It's just amazing. The maturity he had at that point is really quite evident. You know, what was he? 36. Well, at that time he was 38. Yeah. And we have talks of his going back into the 80s. 83, I think, is the first one that's recorded.
And that's when, you know, that's when I was falling in love with him as a teacher.
Yeah, yeah. So you met him in the early 80s or mid-80s or so?
89.
Okay, I see.
Mm-hmm. So 92 was...
Oh, I see. No, 92 was... He was speaking, yeah, from that state of understanding.
Those were some of the last talks before he stopped.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Later. Yeah, I was surprised to see it. So I was looking in the late 90s as we had been playing some of his late 90s. And that one just looked interesting. I listened to it. And then I realized that it was 92 because yeah. I just wasn't paying attention to the actual date until later. I thought, boy, it's a very good talk. So.
Yeah. There's two or three in 92, mm-hmm. and then not till 95.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Well, Larry, when did David first begin to speak in Canada?
Oh, gosh. 95, I think, is the first time.
It was 95 in the summer, just before he called for Kriya in September?
Well, he did a Kriya review in 95 in September, so you're right, yes. So he was talking... He was, yes. No, let's see, where was the... No, the Kriya review was in Seattle. And that was just for devotees who had taken Kriya with Mother. And then 96 in September, he also had... And then he had a general Kriya. His first real Kriya.
Right, because it was in 96 where we met at Phyllis Victory's, and then we came to Seattle for initiation. That's right.
I see.
Yeah, the first talk he gave, I believe, when he came out of the dark night, the first talk would have been up in Vancouver.
That's right.
At Phyllis's request.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think that's when. Thank you, Jill.
Yeah. You guys pulled him out of that.
I was just thinking about the disgust.
Maureen, we can't hear you.
Pardon me, Larry?
Maureen's talking.
Oh, yeah. David came to Victoria much before that. He came probably... 10 years before that or something.
Mother was still alive.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I know. We're just referring specifically to that when he stopped doing talks.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
No, I hadn't thought. You're right. I'll take a look and see how many we have recorded from that time. But yeah, that it would make sense that he was traveling up to Victoria.
I remember him one time. I don't think he came frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thought I'd clarify that.
Yeah.
But, you're...
And Wilmer went to Victoria once or twice, I think, too. And, yeah, I mean, to give a talk also.
Who?
Wilmer. Do you remember him?
Yeah, there was another guy, too.
Dale?
Keith? Not Dale.
Oh, Keith.
Keith, yeah. Keith. Pat Downey used to give talks too.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he gave great talks.
Okay.
Thanks, Maureen. Yeah, thanks. I've been kind of focused on the dark night time when David wasn't doing any service or anything with him. Yeah, and so that's what I meant of his first.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't fully listening.
Well, I guess if I...
I don't know that I clarified that's what I was talking
to Victoria.
Yeah.
No, he came when I was really young. Like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if asked, I would have probably said no, that he hadn't. But so I'm glad to hear that clear. And the tape history would show that if he was recorded at that time, which most of them were, but not all.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not that one.
I'll take a look. Jill actually has more of the database.
But that last Sunday talk, that was 92. That's amazing.
Yeah.
He was so close.
Agreed. Yeah, it was amazing.
Well, and he talked about that pretty eloquently about, you know, when he went into the dark night, it was because he had been feeling so elevated.
Yeah.
That it was so devastating to not feel God.
Yeah.
To know God at that level and then have it all disappear.
Right.
And know it's there. Not think it's gone. Just know that it's exactly. not accessible.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, so like a micro thing when you fall off the honeymoon. It's not in the dark night, but
yeah.
Hard.
I was thinking about the universality of God, and when you mentioned Jill falling in love with David as the teacher, it's something I've said to myself many times, falling in love with God.
Mm-hmm.
He made it possible. Or he was just more. I can't say the icing on the cake. That would not be respectful of my beautiful teacher, my master. But he sure added so much. And
continuation.
Pardon me?
Continuation. Yeah.
And all the times that we couldn't spend with Mother, partly because we weren't as aware as we could have been, and partly because it wasn't possible for us being far away, and then to have David come along and carry on and solidify things for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And really treat us so lovingly. I was going to say, too, you know, I've been thinking lately about a time when I sat at the retreat at Loon Lake, and I don't know when the occasions were, but people would line up and receive their beautiful hugs from David, and he would look into each person's eyes. And there was a little moment when I happened to look up, and the look in David's eyes as he was looking at Lorraine, it brought tears to my eyes because it was the identical love that I received. It was identical. Mm-hmm. It was so beautiful, and I felt it. I felt that same love he was giving to Lorraine come right inside. It was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's say our closing prayer. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection
surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with thee.
My communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Om. 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 Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen.
Amen.